John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for not, oh no, my phone's just sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, December 26, 2011. It's believed a French company is denied a lucrative contract in London due to its involvement and support of Israeli settlement activities, and over 3,000 Palestinians are reported to have been arrested in 2011. These stories and more coming up, so stay tuned. Over the Christmas weekend, on Friday, the EU warned Israel over its intention to link the settlement of Ma'al Yadumim with Jerusalem via more settlement construction on Palestinian land, and their intention of completing segregated roads in areas surrounding Jerusalem, which have been on hold for several years. Jerusalem Mayor Nir Birkat even spoke about the possibility of transferring control of areas within the Jerusalem municipality to the influence of the civil administration run by the Israeli army, due to the Palestinians there being outside of the annexation wall. Several countries, including UN Security Council members, spoke out against the current plans. During a Christmas dinner, Mohammed Ashtaya, member of the Central Committee of Fatah movement, stated that Palestinian lands are for Palestinians, not for settlements. The affair occurred in Bethlehem and was attended by social and political figures, including the governor of Bethlehem and Hebron. Eshteyer added that, quote, should Netanyahu fail to distinguish between Hahumah and Tel Aviv, then we will not distinguish between Ramallah and Jaffa, unquote. His comments came as the lands belonging to the Palestinian Kremezan Monastery, the creators of the Kremezan wine franchise, are being confiscated by Israel, and the nearby settlement of Hahumah is being expanded. In other news, former detainee and Palestinian researcher specialising in detainees' affairs, Abdul Nasir Farana, stated that Israeli soldiers arrested 3,312 Palestinians, including children, since the beginning of this year. Farana stated that the army detained men, women and children, and even went on to take patients and people with special needs. This is besides arrests targeting elected Palestinian political officials and legislators. He said that the army conducted on average 276 arrests each month, nearly 9 arrests per day. Veolia, a French transportation company that has been the target of a campaign by human rights groups around the world for its investments in Israeli settlements, has been denied a contract in West London, leading supporters of the boycott campaign to claim credit. The West London Waste Authority decided this week to deny the French multinational Veolia from the £485 million contract covering 1.4 million inhabitants of the London boroughs of Brent, Ealing, Harrow, Hillingdon, Hounslow and Richmond-upon-Thames for treatment of residual domestic waste. Campaigners point out that Veolia helped to build and is involved in the operation of a tramline which links Jerusalem with illegal Israeli settlements in the Palestinian West Bank. In addition, the company takes waste from Israel and illegal Israeli settlements and dumps this on Palestinian land at the Tovlan landfill. That's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, December 26th daily roundup of news from the occupied Palestinian territories. We hope that you will join us again tomorrow. This was brought to you by Hussam Kassis and me, William Gibson.
Afghanistan yesterday. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unreported nationality from an insurgent attack in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan. Afghanistan yesterday. Insurgents shot down a NATO helicopter in Helmand province. The crew escaped without injury. Afghanistan today. An armed attacker wearing an Afghan army uniform opened fire on coalition troops in western Afghanistan. An official said several NATO troops were wounded in the shooting and the gunman was killed. This has been going on since the days when Afghanistan was fighting the Soviet Union. Pakistan, ongoing. The CIA has been forced to suspend drone bombings in Pakistan as the U.S. government falls, begging to its knees, trying to get Pakistan to reopen the border crossing into Afghanistan for NATO supply convoys. The border was closed after a U.S. airstrike killed 24 Pakistani soldiers. U.S. troops are out of Iraq, except for an estimated 17,000 mercenaries, some from Blackwater, supposedly to guard the U.S. embassy. U.S. troops left quite a nasty war behind in the country they invaded. Baghdad, Iraq, 22nd of December. 11 roadside and car bombs killed at least 62 people and wounded hundreds. Nobody has claimed responsibility for these blasts. Baghdad, Iraq, today. A suicide car bomber blew up a checkpoint leading to the Interior Ministry, killing 7 people and injuring 32 others, according to officials. Saladin Province, Iraq, yesterday. 3 people were killed and 12 wounded in a suicide bomb attack on a checkpoint. Iraq, today. Muqtada al-Sadr is demanding that parliament be dissolved and new elections be held in the wake of such sectarian strife as Prime Minister Maliki's attempt to have the vice president arrested on trumped-up terrorism charges. Many suspect this will bring about the collapse of the supposed power-sharing government in Iraq. Mr. Barack Obama, 8 years of war and occupation didn't pacify Iraq, and nobody has ever conquered Afghanistan. Now's the time to get out of Afghanistan just like you got out of Iraq. Bring your troops home today.
The official U.S. war and occupation of Iraq came to a close with the last American combat troops crossing the border into Kuwait on December 18th. At least 4,485 members of the U.S. military have died in the Iraq War that was launched by President George W. Bush in March 2003. More than 32,000 U.S. servicemen and women have been wounded in hostile action during the course of the 9 years of war. Estimates of the number of Iraqis killed during the war range from 100,000 to over 1 million. Despite the end of America's combat mission in Iraq, the U.S. continues to operate the largest embassy in the world in Baghdad, maintaining a staff of more than 15,000 and 5,000 private security guards. Although President Obama honored the agreement signed by the Bush administration that designated the end of 2011 as the deadline for the withdrawal of all U.S. combat forces, the White House and Pentagon had attempted to leave in place a residual training force of thousands of American troops in Iraq, but that plan failed when the Iraqi government refused to grant legal immunity to American soldiers that remained. As the official conflict ends, Iraq remains a shattered nation, facing difficult challenges in the post-war period, with ongoing ethnic violence, a government racked by internal conflict, high unemployment, and a broken infrastructure. Cindy Sheehan is the mother of U.S. Army Specialist Casey Sheehan, who was killed in Iraq in April 2004. When she set up a peace encampment outside President Bush's Texas ranch in August 2005, Sheehan became the voice and conscience of the anti-war movement. She publicly and repeatedly asked President Bush for what noble cause had her son died. Your reporter spoke with Cindy Sheehan, who reflects on the end of the Iraq War and the legacy for both Americans and Iraqis.
It's very emotional because, of course, it was and is a war based on lies and deception and for control of Iraq's natural resources and for profit. And besides the fact that, you know, that we have an embassy there that's the size of 94 football fields, the largest embassy in the world, and the U.S. is maintaining that with about 16,000 employees, and half of those employees will be private military contractors. And I read that 3,000 troops are staying in Kuwait, just right across the border from Iraq, and of course, we still have a lot of military installations and troops inside the country and surrounding the country. So, I mean, just with the death of Kim Jong-il, we have 30,000 troops still in Korea, and that war has never officially, or that police action has never officially ended. So, you know, there's those thoughts going through my head. But then, you know, of course, the Iraqi people, Barack Obama has never mentioned them. He's mentioned the sacrifice of our troops, but not the 2 million Iraqis that have been killed by the U.S. since the war and sanctions from the first Bush administration, and the millions that have been displaced, and their country's in ruins. I think we owe the people of Iraq so much, but the very least we owe them is building supplies and jobs to get the infrastructure back, and their universities full staff and fully equipped, and their hospitals fully staffed and fully equipped. And their country is contaminated with depleted uranium. So even if the war did end, it's not going to end for me. It's not going to end for the people of Iraq and the other people who have paid such horrible, unnecessary sacrifices for this. You know, the homeless vets and the vets that have brain injuries that aren't getting diagnosed and things like that. It's just a needless tragedy.
Cindy, it seems that officials of the Bush administration who advocated for this war and executed this war in the name of getting rid of weapons of mass destruction that were not there and may have been a false pretext upon which this war was fought in the name of gaining public favor for the war, there really does seem to be no accountability for any of them, higher-ups and those lower officials who lied to the American public about this war. What are your thoughts about accountability at this moment when most U.S. troops have left Iraq?
First of all, the Obama administration, they're preventing and blocking investigations and prosecution or indictments for war crimes and crimes against humanity of the Bush administration. And this would be also a good time to speak about Bradley Manning, who allegedly exposed some of those lies and war crimes, and he's on trial. If he's found guilty, he's charged with a capital crime, or he could spend the rest of his life in prison when he exposed those crimes. So instead of going after the people who committed just profound international crimes and war crimes and crimes against humanity, they're prosecuting and persecuting somebody who exposed those crimes. So that just shows the hypocrisy of this empire.
as we hear the drum beats for a new war with Iran, based on the idea that Iran is developing a nuclear weapons capability, and we're seeing that heat up with the 2012 election campaign and a lot of criticism of President Obama by the Republicans, and certainly he's responding by taking a harder line on Iran. What are some of your thoughts about those drum beats for a new war?
We have to remember that this has been something that has been discussed for years now about Iran and the threat of the U.S., maybe Israel, invading Iran. And I just want to, you know, I'm not giving the Bush administration any passes. I'm not going to give the Obama administration any passes either. I mean, when Obama was running for president, he said that no option was off the table for dealing with Iran. And seriously, I think that the entrance of China and Russia into this debate may force the U.S. and Israel not to deal with this militarily, because the other countries have said that they won't let that just slide, and there will be repercussions if the U.S. or Israel invades Iran. So I'm hoping that, first of all, that's just a scary prospect. I read the other day where an analyst said that he thinks we're going into a new Cold War, which is better than a hot war if there's some tension is there that prevents us going into World War III, because, you know, it seems like with the buildup of military and the buildup of rhetoric in the Middle East and Africa, if the U.S. just doesn't stop, then that might be where we're heading.
That was peace activist Cindy Sheehan. For information on Cindy's radio program, blog, and forthcoming book, visit Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com.
On the third month anniversary of the launch of the Occupy Wall Street encampment in New York City, activists were taking stock of the enormous growth of their movement across the nation and the world, and the subsequent police suppression and eviction of activists from dozens of their camps and public spaces. In New York City, Occupy activists who had earlier been evicted from Zuccotti Park attempted to reoccupy Duarte Square on December 17th, a property owned by Trinity Church, which resulted in some 50 arrests when clergy members and others climbed over the park fence in a symbolic act of civil disobedience. To date, one of the most ambitious protest actions undertaken by Occupy activists was the December 12th shutdown of three of the nation's major ports, Oakland, Portland, and Seattle. The one-day action was organized to draw attention to how the investment firm Goldman Sachs profits from port commerce, as it is a major shareholder in Stevedore Services of America, which is in the midst of a dispute with unionized truck drivers. The action, which was mostly peaceful but took a violent turn in Seattle, has been criticized as not in tune with the wishes of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, whose president publicly opposed the Occupy movement's call for a West Coast port shutdown. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Ian Finkenbinder, a member of Occupy Seattle who helped organize the West Coast port shutdown. He says that while the ILWU leadership had publicly opposed the port action, many rank-and-file members supported it, as did many of the non-union truckers who move goods in and out of the port.
I'd like to clarify that it wasn't that we had non-support from the union. We had non-support from the union's officers. The ILWU issued a statement of non-support about the December 12th West Coast port shutdown, and that's great. We understand that. Legally, those officers have to issue that statement. However, the rank and file, we saw a lot of support. Not all of them, but a lot. In fact, I'd say a majority. That statement of non-support was not put to the union as something that could be voted on. It was just unilaterally decided on by the leadership. So we did a lot of outreach with the unions. We talked to a lot of union members. And honestly, if we felt that it wasn't something that the union members, the rank and file, could get behind, we wouldn't have done it.
And I guess it's true that the union leadership, some people were saying that they had to do it because it was a breach of contract. If they had supported it, they could have been in really big trouble.
Yes, if the union president had said, yeah, let's shut down all the ports, that would have equaled millions of dollars of fines. It would have jeopardized their ability to negotiate better contracts. So that's really, honestly, it's what they had to say. Their hands were tied, whereas our hands weren't. We had the option of shutting down the port, and we sure did.
What was the rationale exactly for shutting down the port? It was intended to be a one-day shutdown, right?
It was intended to be a one-day shutdown, and it was in order to send a message to multinational corporations like Goldman Sachs, who operate these shipping deals through the terminals, and they've been engaging a lot of union-busting tactics, and so we were attempting to send a message to these companies that the workforce is a lot bigger than them. And honestly, they make their millions, their billions, based on the participation of workers.
There was not a lot of violence, as I understand it, and there wasn't a lot of even interaction with the police. Is that, at least in some of the places? How was it in Seattle?
It was pretty crazy. Seattle Police Department actually just received a letter detailing their many, many faults and violations, to include violations of the Constitution. At our blockade, there were a lot of port shutdowns where there wasn't any violence. They actually used tear gas and flashbang grenades on us in order to break up our blockade. So there was violence, but that's pretty common with the Seattle Police Department.
I got an email from a person who was supporting the blockade and trying to, basically he said, keep it nonviolent, and he was brutally attacked by the police. He's a Catholic worker, a group that, you know, is very supportive of the poor.
I met him, and that was horrifying. Basically, he got pushed down by the police while he was standing there shouting, keep the peace, keep the peace, and they punched him in his face while they ground his face into the dirt. It was horrible.
Yeah, that's what he said. He said that he went basically at the request of some of the truckers that he knew, who said that their working conditions and pay and stuff were terrible, and that they would definitely support this action. Can you say anything about the interaction, if any, between the truckers who are not part of a union and the ILWU?
I can't really comment on their relationship with the ILWU. What I can say is my own observation of the different port workers that I saw there. For instance, the machinists did cross our picket line because they are not unionized, but they thanked us for being there in support of port workers. Even though the truck drivers, due to our blockade, it took them like an hour to get out of the port in order to get home or just to go on to their next stop. Even though we delayed them, every time that they pulled through, they would honk at us, they would wave at us, they would give us a thumbs up. I'd say about 80% of them. So their interaction with us, at least, was very good. I think every port worker has a vested interest in these companies being operating on a more beneficial level with their laborers.
And so what's the next step? This was a one-day blockade, and it seemed very powerful. Are you building on this in what way?
Well, for one, it creates not just a media narrative, but also a working relationship with union rank-and-file members. So we've shown that we stand with them, and, you know, honestly, I think that a lot of them are getting involved in an unofficial capacity. So that's great. Also, we're coming up with new ways that we can support working families, at least in the state of Washington where I am, and coming up with new actions and just changing tactics all the time in order to adapt to the many different problems that address the 99%.
That was Ian Finkenbinder of Occupy Seattle. Find links to more news, analysis, and commentary on the Occupy Wall Street movement on our website at btlonline.org.
At about 10 p.m. on the 23rd of December, park police swarmed like goblins over Occupy D.C., searching multiple tents before totally destroying one tent. They arrested three people claiming alcohol was being distributed. In order to do this, they searched many other tents and threatened to arrest photographers at the periphery of McPherson Square. I suspect this attack isn't about alcohol at all, but instead is retaliation for the previous night's incident where a park cop tried to arrest someone for a still unstated offense other than resisting arrest. The cop got his ass kicked and ended up in the hospital before someone tasered and arrested his original target, who was charged with resisting arrest. You may recall that it was an arrest for drinking in public that triggered the Mount Pleasant Uprising in 1991 after a rookie cop shot a Salvadoran man while trying to arrest him for drinking in a park. Word went out that he had been shot while handcuffed, and the Salvadoran community rose in revolt, backed up by seemingly everyone in the area.
Arizona's tough guy sheriff Joe Arpaio of Maricopa County is accused of violating the civil rights of Latinos in a report by the U.S. Justice Department. Arpaio is blamed for profiling Latino residents in Greater Phoenix and launching anti-immigrant sweeps targeting Latinos who hadn't broken any laws. The U.S. Justice Department conducted a three-year investigation of the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office and Arpaio, who has strong connections to the right-wing Tea Party movement. The Justice Department had to go to court to gain access to critical documents for its investigation. Arpaio dismissed the civil rights report as political. The Justice Department review found 20% of traffic stops during Arpaio's anti-immigrant sweeps from 2006 to 2009 were done without any reasonable suspicion. Inside the county jails, Latino inmates who spoke little English were punished for not responding to commands in English. Punishment included being sent to solitary confinement for 23 hours a day. Arpaio's jail officers were also accused of using racial slurs against Latino inmates. In recent weeks, Arpaio has faced growing calls for his resignation. The sheriff faces an ongoing investigation into charges that he abused his power. Arpaio is also under fire for failing to properly investigate 400 cases of sex crimes, including dozens of cases of child molestation allegations. Alessandra Solar Mitzi of the ACLU of Arizona observes Sheriff Arpaio, quote, embodies everything that goes wrong when local police waste law enforcement resources targeting people because of their race and skin color.
This song goes out to all you goons at Homeland Security, the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and police organizations that are trying to attack Occupy camps all across the U.S. Rich takes it for his children and rags welfare reform. Let them eat cake. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shopping malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line. Fat in your belly too. See the greed of the shopping malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line. Fat in your belly too. Bye, 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 bye. Rich takes it for his children and rags welfare reform. Let them be kicked. Why should we care? Bye, 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 bye. See the greed of the shopping malls as they pick your pockets clean. Fat in the bottom line. Fat in your belly too.
All the lobbyists on K Street have been eating like pigs for the past few days. Adrienne Parsons at Occupy DC is now on day 19 of his hunger strike, demanding voting rights and budget autonomy for DC. Today he released a Twitter post stating that for every $1 spent lobbying, a corporation receives between $6 and $20 in tax breaks, earmarks, and more. This one's for you, Adrian.
I don't mind stealing bread from the mouths of decadence. But I can't feed on the powerless when my cup's already on the table of fire.
Twitter has just got caught suspending or deleting accounts of users who talk too much about Occupy Wall Street. One user, David Seaman at the Business Insider, reported that his account was suspended for annoying our users after just two tweets about Occupy Wall Street that must have been followed by the wrong people. This is in spite of the fact that those who do not like Occupy Wall Street could have simply unfollowed him. During a little digging, he found three more users who had been removed from Twitter for the same so-called offense. Hey Twitter, this is some change from standing down a service upgrade that would have disrupted service during the revolt in Iran. What does Occupy Wall Street need to do to avoid random account suspensions? Move to Iran? Seriously, folks? This is why I've been telling you for years to never trust corporate social media like Facebook and obviously Twitter as well. Any cloud service owned by a corporation and supporting itself by advertisements has a vested interest in censoring and snitching on any kind of activism that threatens corporate profits. Still wonder why we need things like pirate radio and independent media centers that don't support themselves by advertising?
As 2011 comes to a close, the year has seen the United States set a record for billion-dollar extreme weather disasters. Major storms, deaths, and record property damage occurred across the country, from a heat wave in Texas to a massive tropical storm that hit the Northeast, leaving millions of people without power. According to the Associated Press, the damage caused by severe storms this year has surpassed all the damage from extreme weather during the entire decade of the 1980s. Scientists attribute the extent of storm damage in 2011 to the growing impact of climate change and some bad luck. All told, 2011 witnessed over $52 billion worth of damages. In a recent speech, NOAA Administrator Jane Lubchenco called this year's extreme weather a harbinger of things to come, with more record heat waves, droughts, and big storms.
On the 25th of December, Christmas Day in the Southern Ocean, the whales got their gift from Sea Shepherd. An unmanned drone aircraft, the Nicole Montecalvo, found the whalers and their factory ship, the Nishan Maru, while they were still 1,000 miles away from the whale sanctuary. The two security ships tailing the Steve Irwin have turned out once again to be ordinary harpoon ships, not Japanese warships. As a result, the illegal whalers, poachers according to international law, are going to have a very, very hard time this year. Last year, it took a manned helicopter 18 hours of flight time to locate the factory ship. The whalers escaped when the pilot was forced to land for a nap. That cost a few hundred whales their lives. Sea Shepherd managed to catch the whalers again, even sending them home a month early, but the hope was to keep them from killing a single whale. This year, Sea Shepherd has multiple drones, and drones don't have to sleep. The drones can alternate flight coverage 24/7, one after the other, indefinitely. They fly too high for the whalers to shoot down, yet close enough to easily photograph and vector in the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society's three ships for direct action. Security ships can radio the positions of Sea Shepherd ships all they want. It won't let any of the poaching ships escape, not with a drone glued solidly to the Nishan Maru's wake at all times. Meanwhile, citizen groups in Japan are outraged that some of the international donations earmarked for relief and recovery after last spring's devastating earthquake and tsunami have been diverted to the whalers. That money is needed for things like cleaning up the terrible radioactive mess TEPCO's nuclear reactors brought back to Japan, not to subsidize poachers who bring the whole country nothing but shame and empty cargo holds. Will this be the year the whales can truly celebrate VSO Day for victory in the Southern Ocean?